Talkers.
Welcome to No Prize from God, episode 27. No Prize from God features conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. I'm your host, Ryan J. Downing, and my guest this episode is Adam Morris, author of the book American Messiahs, False Prophets of a Damned Nation. Adam is a writer, editor, and literary translator based in California. He is a recipient of the Susan Sontag Foundation Prize in Literary Translation, a Northern California Book Award in Prose Translation, and a PhD in Literature from Stanford University. What makes this book so perfect for No Prize from God is that, as the New Yorker put it, it's all about how cults made America. In the book, Morris persuasively argues that, at least politically, some messianic movements were often light years ahead of their time. He examines the lives and beliefs of a linked procession of self-appointed prophets who tried to upend American religion and the American way of life. The book tells the stories of people like Cyrus Teed, who founded the Koreshan Unity Commune, Quaker pacifist Jemima Wilkinson, who called herself the Public Universal Friend, the All Friend, and the Comforter, among other names, Thomas Lake Harris, leader of the Brotherhood of New Life, Father Divine from the 1930s, and one of Divine's followers, the Reverend Jim Jones. As the New Yorker article explains, Morris's account of Jones's bizarre star-crossed life is quite good, and he helpfully lingers on how completely a man of the evangelical left Jones was. For the vast majority of American history, as Morris reminds us, movements we would today call evangelical were largely leftist, which is best evidenced by the towering figure of William Jennings Bryan. Abolitionism was an obviously leftist concern, as was feminism, but so was, at one time, temperance. All three movements were spurred on by influential American evangelicals pursuing their own version of social justice. This was the Christian tradition from which Jim Jones emerged, outspoken, fiery, and unmistakably progressive. Adam and I have a fascinating conversation about this book, one of my favorites so far, with No Prize from God. You can always learn more about our guests and the topics we discuss at noprizefromgod.com. You can follow No Prize from God on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at SuperheroHQ. And you can check out other PopCurse shows at PopCurse.com. Remember, the best way you can support this podcast is to leave a 5-star rating and write a nice little review on Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast platform of choice. So here it is, my conversation with Adam Morris. This is No Prize from God. Background and how you came to discover that the written word was not only going to be a big part of your life, but was going to become your career.
Well, that's a long story, but I am from central Pennsylvania. That's where I grew up. It's a pretty insular part of the country, not many portals to the outside world, especially in the 80s and 90s when I was growing up there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things, I didn't have really a literary family, not a lot of books in the house, although we did go to the library quite a bit as a kid. We were very, you know, working class family. That's just one of the things we did. And one of my escapes as a kid who didn't really fit into any other, you know, outlet typical to what kids are supposed to do was books. That's a pretty typical story among writers, as well as academics. And, fast forward, I went to college. I majored in English. I pursued graduate education. I actually have a PhD in Spanish and Portuguese and work as a literary translator. But before doing any of that, I was living in Philadelphia one summer doing a nonprofit internship with an arts organization. And the organization was called First Person Arts, and it's a storytelling, memoir, and documentary organization. They support what I believe is the only festival of memoir and documentary exclusive art in the country. And it was maybe in its fourth year when I was working there, and the two folks who were my coworkers, one of them had known everything there was to know about Philadelphia and really got me interested in local history. And actually, that was how I first found out about Father Divine was from her.
It's fascinating. Yeah, and I, some similarities here. I also come from a blue collar working class family, and while I've lived in California for the last 20 years, I was born and raised in Indianapolis. And yeah, similar story in terms of escaping into books, especially for me, it was fantasy and sci-fi and comic books and music and all of that stuff, became a big part of my life. As an adult, I find, for better or worse, all of my reading is nonfiction. I can't remember the last time I read a book of fiction, actually. But yeah, and then the memoir thing also hits right where I live as I, the end of this year, will have my first co-write published by a, legitimate publishing entity, one might say. And it's a memoir that I did with a friend of mine, who's a guy, best known for being in a band and that sort of thing. And I've got two more of those in the works next year. So, yeah.
Congratulations.
So, thank you. And so, yeah, so it's all right at my alley, everything you're talking about. And also, it's interesting, before we get into American Messiahs, it's interesting that you're talking about some of that local history and lore and strange stories, on the ground in a place like Pennsylvania. Because in working on this book with my buddy Andy, he was born and raised in Cincinnati. And we ended up with a whole chapter about strange occurrences and folklore and ghost stories and urban legends in the Cincinnati area. And that really broadened my perspective on those sorts of stories about how, as much as we think about America as being super homogenized, right? And everything has a strip mall and a Starbucks and a McDonald's, how there is a lot of this strange, oftentimes esoteric, pseudo supernatural, history all around America that's very localized. And I think that was one of the big attractions to the book for me was, some stories I was familiar with but didn't know all of the details about. And then there are plenty of characters who pop up in American Messiahs that I'd never heard of.
Yeah, and I have a lot to say about that, actually. I mean, we don't even have to get into upstate New York right now. I'll just stay on Pennsylvania. We can maybe move on to upstate New York later. The famous burned over district up there. I've spent a lot of time there for research, but Pennsylvania, it was a place I took for granted growing up. I mean, I think everybody kind of does that with the place where they're from. They don't think very critically about what they see or what the social environment is really like. And I grew up in Lancaster County in the heart of Amish Dutch country. So there were a lot of Amish, Old Order Mennonites, and so forth, plainclothes brethren communities, the Ephrata Cloister, which is the archaeological site of an 18th century cult, if you will, in Ephrata, Pennsylvania is nearby. And these were all things that just kind of seemed like a background to me. And, Pennsylvania is also very odd in the sense I didn't fully appreciate how odd it was really until I got out. It's got its urban core, on the two flanks with Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. Philadelphia is very much the Northeast corridor. Amish Dutch country is only 2 hours west of there. Couldn't be, more radically different in terms of the sociology of the area. And then just immediately to the west of there begins Appalachia. I mean, people forget that Pennsylvania is an Appalachian state. It's very wooded, pretty much. Like, I don't know what percentage of the state is state game land, but a lot of it is forested and, very still mysterious. And the part I was from in the, Harrisburg, Lancaster, exurban area had a lot of history that was being erased because of the way the Rust Belt has been abandoned. And so when, for example, President Trump gave that much derided speech on his inauguration day about American carnage, I'm by no means a supporter of the president, but I knew exactly what he was talking about. That was the visual landscape of my childhood, was, pulling up to a video store in a strip mall, in 1990 or whatever, with my mom in her banged up car. And, half the stores were closed, and there was, a five and dime store called James Way, and maybe a pet store and a few other really arbitrary businesses that were hanging on. And, the parking lot full of weeds and that kind of thing. So that really, it was growing up in that area that led me to have such a strong interest in the Philadelphia region's history. When I moved to the city to do that internship, it was, like I said, between years of college. And I was on this grant that let you do a nonprofit internship so that the nonprofit didn't have to pay you and the college paid you. And I scraped by on $2,500 for the whole summer, eating a lot of pasta, but it allowed me to walk around the city a whole bunch because I, couldn't really even afford bus fare. And I saw so much that really surprised me. I mean, here is a city that I didn't go to much as a kid because we were country people. We didn't do that. And I see all of these buildings, some of which were industrial and abandoned, and that I was kind of accustomed to, but a lot of grand-looking civic or residential buildings that had also been abandoned, whole entire neighborhoods that were abandoned, or semi-abandoned. And these properties, especially a lot of the locations of former civic institutions that really upheld the city before its economic collapse and depopulation over the course of 50 years. It was those buildings that really piqued my curiosity because they were evidence of a different kind of social habitus in that region. And one of those buildings, as I said earlier, or as I alluded to, was the Divine Lorraine Hotel. I mean, it's got this huge neon sign that at that time wasn't lighting up anymore. The Divine Lorraine was abandoned in 1999. I was seeing it after 5 years of it, 5 or 6 years or so of it going to rack and ruin, covered in graffiti, boarded up, and looking really just bizarre. A 10-story former luxury apartment building on one of the principal arteries of the city, maybe 10 blocks from City Hall, just lurching into disrepair. And I became very interested at that moment or over the course of that summer in these kind of forgotten episodes of American history, which is really eventually what led, I don't know, 10 years later to the publication of my book.
Wow. And I suppose it should come as a little shock to me that a PhD and multilingualist is so well spoken. But this is a treat, so I appreciate even just listening to you. Believe it or not, I've actually spent a little bit of time in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, visiting a business that was once headquartered there called Relapse Records. And it fits right into your that whole juxtaposition of the myriad of, the intersection of all those disparate and strange cultures, and that Relapse is primarily known for death metal and other extreme genres. And at the time, they were headquartered in the basement of what I can best describe as a Santa Claus store. It was like one of those tiny kind of rundown strip malls, and it just was a place that sold Christmas decorations, I believe, year round. And yeah, as you were sort of on the approach driving up the road to get to Relapse Records, you were going through Amish country. So yeah, you look to your left and your right, and there's Amish land, and then you pull up in the parking lot, there's the Santa Claus store, and then you walk down a set of steps into the basement, and there are a bunch of, you know, long-haired malcontent cretins blasting the most obscene death metal. And yeah, boy, if that doesn't kind of summarize what you're describing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talk now, especially since COVID-19, of people moving back to these ex-urban cities because they have great housing stock. I mean, Lancaster has beautiful historic homes, and they have developed over the last 10, 15 years of this nationwide rental crisis, the same kind of amenities in terms of coffee shops and breweries and whatever that bigger cities have. And people forget that they kind of always did have this variegated social complexion. You know, a lot of pretty much the only place when I was growing up where racial minorities lived was in the ex-urban cities surrounding all this farmland, interspersed throughout all this farmland. And Lancaster has one of the highest concentrations of Syrian refugees because the Mennonites have done such an amazing job opening their homes and their churches and everything else to them. So I don't know if it's got the highest concentration, but it's up there. And, you know, there's all these unexpected things going on in places like that. And I'm really glad to know that you've been to Lancaster. It's in so many ways constitutive or maybe illustrative of a lot of the kinds of social contradictions that get lost in this narrative propelled by social elite media on both coasts.
Indeed. Yeah, I've also spent some time in Greensburg, where I have some close friends who grew up there, and some of them, you know, moved away to Brooklyn and Philadelphia, and much to your point, just about all of them have gone back. They're all in Greensburg again as, you know, adults raising families and so on. I was looking at my childhood home in Southport, Indiana yesterday. One of my oldest friends, who was my neighbor back then and lives in Alaska now, he got to looking at our old neighborhood and was sending me links. And yeah, my childhood home sold last summer for $160,000. And for me living in Orange County, California in 2020, that is fascinating, I guess, is one word.
Now, you said you're from Indianapolis area. Where you grew up, obviously the sort of adopted hometown of Jim Jones. I guess I'm the one asking you the question.
No, please,
right now,
go for it.
What was your exposure to that growing up? I mean, I'm not really sure when you grew up or what kind of legacy remained of People's Temple.
Well, it's a great question because I'm Generation X, so I think we're probably somewhat close in age. But I was, you know, I graduated from high school in 1992. So my first memories of Jim Jones and the association with Indiana was, believe it or not, when Raiders of the Lost Ark came out, because people are talking about this great movie hero, Indiana Jones, and all of the adults were snickering because apparently Indiana Jones was a nickname for Jim Jones in those books.
Oh, right. I never thought about that.
And that's how I learned about the whole story of Jonestown was, at some point asking my dad, hey, why is this so funny to all of you? I could just sense that there was something. They were tickled by the idea of a movie character named Indiana Jones for an altogether different reason. So that's how I learned about it. And, you know, part of it might be my own personal interest in this stuff, but there were, you know, I had awareness of Jim Jones. I had some awareness that Charles Manson had spent some small portion of time in the Midwest. I think he was incarcerated in Ohio at some point. And, so there was some kind of Manson connection that you would hear about in Indiana in certain quarters. And then there were people in nearby Ohio, like Jeff Lundgren. And, I would definitely, as a teenager especially, start to learn about and hear about some of these interesting and bizarre sects that that were around. We also
Right.
had, I mean, I suppose this isn't unlike a lot of other places, but we also had a, at one point, pretty thriving white supremacist skinhead problem in our punk and hardcore scene of the late 80s. It kind of dissipated by the early 90s and then had a resurgence at some point in the mid to late 90s. But it was, Indiana was home base for a couple of the larger factions of white supremacist so-called skinheads. I say so-called skinheads because we were also fortunate enough to have traditional skins and sharp skins and, you know, those sorts of groups going on at the same time. But I bring that up because those guys being around was my first encounter with the sort of neo-pagan Odinism stuff. You know,
Right.
seeing people wearing Thor's hammers and that sort of thing that, you know, now I see in like, I've been binge watching The Last Kingdom, a Viking show that's on Netflix from the UK. And it's sort of like all that stuff comes rushing back because it's like, oh, I, you know, I saw people who were kind of adopting this as a costume as when I was a teenager. But yeah, so going back to this idea for American Messiahs and this great Genesis story, no pun intended, that you've just outlined for what would inevitably become the book. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is the kind of overarching theme of the book
Right.
seems to be that, and I think I even just described these as bizarre, wayward cults, and, you know, for lack of a better descriptor, but your book posits and I think makes a very strong, persuasive argument for the idea that these aren't aberrations in American history. These are essential to American history. If you could kind of expand on that a little bit, I'd love that.
Yeah. So one of the things that really guided me as I, two things actually, I'll say that really guided me as I was researching and then writing the book, and especially as I was conducting interviews with some surviving members of the Peace Mission and People's Temple. And the first thing that I'll say, just because I think it's so important, is so many people have judged these groups based on what they did. And People's Temple is a very good example of one, and we'll acknowledge that it was a horrible incident, but one terrible thing that kind of eclipsed everything else the group did. And that was the group suicide, which 918 people died. And I wanted to focus on what they thought they were doing. And that's an important distinction for all of the groups that I look at in the text. And it was something that I had to keep at the forefront of my mind as I went through archives and read letters, especially from some of these 19th century groups where there aren't any survivors, obviously, around to interview or to tell the story. We only have the written archive. And some people have criticized me and my book for not exposing these leaders or the members of these groups more as frauds or as having conducted some kind of fraudulent enterprise or having deluded or duped their followers. Frankly, I think that is just the nature of religion. People like following leaders. And just because these were minority religions, minority in the sense that they never attain any kind of mainline status, doesn't really differentiate them qualitatively from other religions that did, like Mormonism or Christianity for that matter. And so there's that distinction between what people did and what they thought they were doing, because a lot of the other groups in the text are also judged on their failures to accomplish what they said they were going to do. And I don't think that's as relevant as their sincere belief and dedication of their entire lives to some of those projects. And the second idea is the psychoanalytic idea of the repressed and the return of the repressed. And what I really see happening with American history as told through the rise and fall of messianic groups, and I can say more about why I chose the ones that I did, mainly it was because they were the most successful, in quotations, at garnering members and longevity of the organization. But what I really saw was that there's a continuity from the pre-independence era of the colonial era of, the Puritan settlements, all the way through, even past Jonestown, really, but all the way through the 70s, most certainly, of groups, Christian groups, Judeo-Christian groups, rediscovering certain aspects of Christ's teachings as well as the original church that's described, albeit somewhat obliquely, in the book of Acts, the Acts of the Apostles. And there are these passages, two verses in particular, that suggest that the first communities of Christians held all property in common and did not respect private property and welcomed everyone, rich or poor, into their ranks. And so you see this rhetoric resurface in every single one of the six primary groups that I profiled in the book, as well as many others that, I didn't have the space to do a complete catalog of every messianic sect in America because there were so many.
So many.
Yeah, so what you have is a country that was founded on the one hand by religious dissidents who thought they were reforming a church that had gone astray, that had really become seduced by power and property in England following the English Reformation. And the separatist Puritans, who were the first ones to come over, were separatists because they really thought the church could not even be reformed from within, so they wanted to separate. And that impulse to separate from the established mainline Christian church of whatever one's time period is what you see happening over and over and over again with each of these groups. It's what Jim Jones said he was doing. It's what Father Divine said he was doing. It's what Cyrus Teed and Thomas Lake Harris said they were doing. In every case, I mean, some of the most extreme rhetoric came from Cyrus Teed, who said the established Reformed churches, Reformed basically just meaning Protestant, had prostituted themselves, had given up on reforming the reforming mission that Martin Luther had inaugurated, and that was really at the basis of the Reformation, was getting back away from the doctrine and the sort of fetishism of the Catholic Church and its political intrigue and back towards a more pure Christian community like the ones described in the New Testament. And so each of these groups sees themselves doing that. The Shakers thought they were establishing and really believed that they were establishing the millennial church in America. And you cannot question the sincerity of people who devote their entire lives to a project like this. And, that's an area where I've gotten into disagreements with other scholars who, well, actually, really not the scholars, primarily readers and critics who want me to be more suspicious of the motives of the group members, and in some cases, especially People's Temple, but in particular, the leaders.
And yet, as you said, you could cast those same suspicions on more successful faith traditions, which isn't to say that every one of the Abrahamic faiths and all of the major religions of the world, I would love to see a math breakdown proportionately of atrocities associated with these larger ones versus these smaller ones. It's like maybe some of these smaller groups didn't have the opportunity to have more crimes and misdeeds associated with them, and also more good works associated with them, just simply by nature of the fact that they never got any larger. I think one thing that confuses the issue for a lot of people is that a lot of the discussions around some of these sects and organizations are intertwined with reasonable discussions about other things we value or other things we might support. I mean, for example, and you talk about the OG Koresh in your book, but for example, with Waco, there are folks who look at it as government overreach and abuse of power and a execution by the powers that be. And the will, the right to freedom of religion and self-determination. There's all these like libertarian arguments, that are in favor of the Branch Davidians, and then there's the religious side of it and the problematic, to say the least, views and practices. And then it gets into, as you've pointed out, how much more or less problematic were some of those views and practices and the charisma of its theater and so on than other comparable groups that are more mainstreamed or larger. So I think that it gets confusing when people's emotions get tied up in conversations about these groups, because it all sort of, it's just such a mess of different things that are converging in these stories, you know?
It is. And, you know, I'd only touch on the Branch Davidians briefly at the conclusion of the book because they've been so widely studied already.
Mm-hmm.
But the justification in that case for the very extreme government intervention that happened was that they might commit mass suicide and children might be involved in that against their will, as happened basically not even 20 years beforehand in Jonestown. And it's such a strange appeal because the result ended up being a raid that killed everyone anyway. And what was really at stake there, of course, there were also allegations of child abuse, which were unfounded, according to government investigators who had already completed an investigation. But what was really at stake is American culture has learned to dislike closed and somewhat secretive groups, especially if they are religious in nature. And I think everything I've written about in the book can show you why. One reason is those groups don't participate in the economy in the way that Americans are expected to. And that was, I didn't finish my thought earlier, but that was the second point I was going to bring up of this founding tension and the return of the repressed. We had a society that was founded by those religious dissenters that I mentioned who were trying to purify their society and purify the church by starting over in America.
Mm-hmm.
But immediately after that, because of the way mercantilism was shaping the world, you have very enterprising, swashbuckling entrepreneurs getting there too. And there's this founding tension in New England between business and religious reform. And it really never goes away. The capitalist corruption of the churches is what all of the leaders in my book keep railing against. And you see it in various manifestations. In the Gilded Age, when Cyrus Teed was gathering all of his followers, it was the exploitation of labor, which was horrific compared to the standards that we've come to expect today, although Amazon does seem determined to go back to the 19th century. And what you really saw was people, religious leaders saying, and they were a minority of religious leaders saying, this is unconscionable, this is terrible, this is not Christian, this is exploitative, and so on. And you have the mainstream churches kind of allying with business people. And that is really what drove people to join groups like the Koreshian Unity and later, during the Great Depression, Father Divine's Peace Mission.
Wow, and that's, you've really hit upon something with the labor thing and how that is part of the history and the shaping of America. It does appear as another theme throughout the book. And, you know, I'm reminded of so many stories from so many of these groups. Of course, the name's escaping me right now, but there's one organization I read a profile on that is a splinter group of the Nation of Islam, one of the groups that split off following the death of its founder, or I suppose not its founder, but Elijah Muhammad, its most prominent leader. And one of the main things about that profile was the child labor, you know, kids being as young as 9 and 10 years old working in these religious group owned restaurants. With standards that are completely illegal and immoral by current mores, even with what Amazon gets away with, and yet the religious element, the religious compulsion, keeps parents putting their kids there, as an alternative to, as you said, a participation in the economy in the way that most of us expect everyone else to participate. It's really fascinating to think about that in terms of shaping how our society is structured and where the religious views informed a lot of this stuff.
Right. And the parallel that I know the most about with that is obviously Father Divine. And it's hard to count membership with the Peace Mission because they didn't keep those kind of records. And it's hard to know how many people actually thought Father Divine was God versus lived in one of his heaven's extensions or worked in one of his co-op businesses. But a conservative estimate is a couple of million people. And that's a lot. And what that was a couple of million people during a very economically fragile time in the country who were not only participating in this parallel economy. Father Divine was fond of capitalism in the sense that he used it to advance his own ends, but they had this network of businesses that stretched from coast to coast. And if you were a follower who lived in one of the communes and worked in one of the businesses, you really weren't participating in the rest of the economy because a lot of the patrons of Father Divine's restaurants, which were the most common type of establishment that they had, they were the poor and indigent who came for the cheap meals during the Depression and during the war, and they were other members of the community. You had an automatic base for your business to succeed if you got Father Divine's name on it. And those people had to come up with their own startup capital for those businesses, and they worked hard to earn it. But once it was all set up, they were in a parallel economy, a sort of sub-network of businesses within the larger capitalist enterprise. And that's threatening on the face of it already. But Father Divine was using those farms in upstate New York to source his New York City restaurants. It was getting pretty complex, the level of logistical integration he had imagined. And he's buying all these fancy properties and doing what was just anathema at the time, which was integrating them. And this becomes an economic threat on many levels because, as you know, or as I would posit, Jim Crow and American racism has a strong class dimension, and the economy, quote unquote, needed a subclass of citizens to exploit. It always does. That's how capitalism works. And right now, the subclass or extremely low wage workers are all overseas because of neoliberal restructuring. But at the time, we were at war, or there was the Depression, and production was pretty much domestic, and cheap labor had to be found somewhere. And Father Divine was subverting the paradigm completely, not only the economic arrangement, but the racial relations that undergirded the success of that relationship.
Wow, this is delivering in every way that I hoped that it would and more. So thank you for that. I have two other sort of big questions related to the book and about the book. I'll start with this one because you just opened a nice door into it. Of the groups that you profiled, what are, in your mind, some of the positive things that they brought to the table into the fabric of America and its development? Because of course, when we think about, say, the Jonestown group, we think about, the how it ended. What, if anything, about some of these organizations do you think were positive things that perhaps linger on or triggered other positive developments in communities?
I'm going to start in a really su maybe surprising and unexpected place with this and connect it back to the mention that you made of Charles Manson. And the Manson family is pretty well known as a cult, but it did have a belief system. And when I was first getting interested in this subject, I also read Helter Skelter. And I was young when I read it. I was in my early 20s, and I got the chills on a summer day just having the realization that I easily could have been conscripted into a group like that because of how alienated I felt from sort of mainstream society at certain points in my life. And I
That's
realized.
why I'm doing this podcast now. Yeah,
Yeah,
having
and
that
so
same
that's, yeah,
weird
it's that
sense of
feeling of
familiarity when you
alienation.
study some of these groups where you're like, oh man, I could have been susceptible to this.
Completely. Yeah, it's that sense of alienation that I recognized in primarily the young women that he recruited to the group. There were some men too. And, you know, that's roughly contemporaneous with People's Temple. And I've spoken to a lot of people who were members of People's Temple who are survivors. They either left the group before its final phases for various reasons, or they never made it to Jonestown. Or in one case, and she has recently passed away, a woman who was not only in Jonestown for everything. She only happened to be away on that day that the suicides happened. She was a procurer and she was on their boat going to Georgetown, the capital, to get supplies. And she has said, I believe she said it on Anderson Cooper's show, that if she had been there, she would have committed suicide. And, you know, this was supposed to be kind of a gotcha, aha question. By sensationalizing it like that, the Cooper and the show, they were kind of missing the point, which is how attractive the group's ideology actually was. And I'll use People's Temple as an example because most people find it so typical of a cult or of the dangers of these kind of groups. And in some ways it is, but what they the group had a long history. You know, Jim Jones was in Indianapolis in the 50s building the first integrated congregation. So you have to give him that. You have to give him the fact that he was committed to racial integration throughout his whole entire career. Did he have other, perhaps, psychotic tendencies? I would suppose so. And there's plenty of evidence for that. Did he become abusive and a drug addict and completely paranoid by the end of his life? Yes, there's lots of evidence there. But he wasn't the only person in the group, and he didn't single-handedly determine people's relationship to it. There was a whole satellite congregation in Los Angeles, right? Pretty big. And he wasn't down there that often. You know, they would, at the peak of his Los Angeles community, he was going down maybe once a week or twice a month. But a lot of people really believed in the stated ideology of the group, which is why I always go back to what the group thought it was doing. And they were trying to build a community of mutual aid and support and social activism. They were huge, especially in the Bay Area, in social activism, medical aid to the needy, meals, and so forth. He copied a lot of Father Divine's methods after visiting the Peace Mission. But they were trying to build a raceless or a society where racism, classism, and ageism would no longer exist. And they did, down to the tiniest details, practice that. Jones always instructed members who were living in the communes that each of the communes had to be integrated to the extent possible. Even when they were living in Redwood Valley, you know, a couple hours north of San Francisco, when that was a very conservative area back then, and he demanded that when they went places in cars, that a white person and a black person sit together in the car. And you have to take the group in all of its complexity to understand why people were attracted to it. And Laura Johnson Cole, the member that I was referring to earlier who has just passed away, she explained how she had tried to get involved with the Black Panthers. She didn't really feel like she fit in. The energy surrounding everything that was happening in the 60s drove her and a lot of other people to radical groups. People's Temple was far from the only one. And, you know, she didn't join the Weathermen, but she had a religious orientation and she felt the pull towards this group that was kind of rebooting Christianity, rebooting these ideas of charity, aid, assistance, and so forth, and equality. Equality was the biggest one. And really practicing what they were preaching. At least that's what it seemed to people who joined. And, you know, there are stories of the deterioration of that mission over the years and how it was corrupted, as religions always are, by power, namely Jim Jones' pursuit of power in San Francisco government, and his grandiose illusions of himself as a national political figure. That's really, I think, where he was thinking he was heading. And by the time they get to South America, as an international pariah, is kind of how he viewed himself. And yeah, I mean, we laugh, but there's so many tapes. It was the 70s, right? They taped everything. And you can listen to them all yourself because the FBI has them on their website, and so does the Jonestown Project through San Diego State University. And you can hear how you hear evidence of his manipulation, but you also hear evidence of regular members' sincerity. And
right.
The way there was a veneer of communism and democracy, or what we could call socialist democracy, adhering to every aspect of their meetings. They incorporated Maoist practices of group criticism. They, by the end, really saw themselves as a Marxist-Leninist organization. They were far from the only group with those kind of leanings in the 60s reacting to the political climate. So unless you comprehend the whole thing, you will just see it as a cult, and it won't make sense except as mind control. And some of my critics have said I don't account for mind control, but that's because I don't believe in it. And, you know, people have taken issue with that. I believe in mind control only insofar as ideological conditioning can be thought of as mind control. And that's really what was going on in all of these groups, most powerfully in People's Temple.
I would absolutely agree with you, and I think you make a very persuasive argument about this particular point. To me, I see, ideological conditioning, it's the frog in boiling water, right? I mean, that's how people end up with the most extreme end, where, of course, when someone breaks one of these organizations down to you by all of their worst attributes and wackiest sounding beliefs, you go, well, that's easy to reject. Anyone who doesn't is clearly a fool or is, you know, being mind controlled. And it neglects the number of truthful things and good works, so to speak, you know, to paint with a broad brush, that attract people in the first place. And then also the reasons why people stay even as they encounter the things that are less savory, and why, and people to think they can reform organizations from within, or, you know, resurrect some sort of true spirit of the group, right? And wrestle it away from people who are poisoning it, or what have you. I mean, yeah, as you said, there's so much context that goes around each of these organizations and the little that most of us know about them that haven't studied them. So yeah, I think that's fascinating. The other big question I wanted to ask you is, in terms of continuity between the messianistic figures that you chose to profile and the organizations that were around them, can you point to anything that they share in terms of why they collapsed? Why? I mean, the obvious answer would seem to be, well, when it's based around the charisma of a particular leader and that leader's gone, that's generally the end. But we could also point to other religions and organizations where that hasn't been the case, where there's either been successors or there's been, you know, a deification of that original figure. Why do you think the groups that you profiled, do they share anything in common about why they are more or less no more today?
The ones that disappear refuse to go mainstream in some way or another. Mm-hmm. And the counterexample is Mormonism. Mormonism did have a communal phase. It did have a charismatic, not a messiah, but a prophet in Joseph Smith. He was even martyred, you know, in his jail cell. His writings are not that persuasive as scripture. I'll just put it that mildly. And the group had all the trappings that people would associate with a cult, including aberrant sexual practices, which, whether or not a minority religion has aberrant sexual practices, they will always be alleged, because that's an easy way to take them out. Hmm. That's sort of what happened to Thomas Lake Harris here in California. And America is at core still a puritanical nation. We don't like wife swapping. Look at what happened to the Oneida community. You know, it lasted a long time until people got wind of, or the wrong people got wind of the type of aberrant sexual practice they had there, namely complex marriage by which everyone in the community of 200 people was married to everyone else. And right, and the older women initiating younger men into sex because that was believed to be the most responsible way to do it, and vice versa with young girls sleeping with older men. And we look at that from all of today's vantage points, and we evaluate it with today's morals and so on. But had that group abandoned those practices in the way that Mormonism eventually abandoned polygamy before that, long before that had abandoned its communal aspects, although I would be remiss not to remark that some polygamous and communal Mormon splinter sects still do exist in Utah and elsewhere.
And the Mormons also had to integrate eventually, right? Because wasn't there
– That's right.
There was a period where I think someone sued to get in, which is, you know, it reminds me of the quote about not wanting to be a member of any group that would have me, but
and now one of their biggest selling points is how diverse the church has become, and I believe the black woman congress person from Salt Lake City, Mia Love, I believe she was a Mormon. Whenever I go to New York City, I always see ads for the Mormon church, and it's got a very diverse face on the ad usually. And when you go to Salt Lake City, as I have done, you see how diverse the – I don't know what they do or why all these missionaries congregate there. I mean, it's the capital of the church. But they bring people from all over the world there as part of their mission, just like they send people out all over the world from the U.S. And it's extremely diverse. A lot of Mormon communities in Mexico and in Asia and so on. So yeah, they develop ways not to be destroyed by the society at large, because when too many social sins aggregate, eventually the citizenry locally or nationally will appeal to law enforcement to get rid of these groups. And that is a trend you see with Father Divine, you see it with Cyrus Teed, Thomas Lake Harris, and obviously with Jim Jones. I mean, as paranoid as he was, you know, paranoid people are often correct that someone is out to get them, and that becomes a spiral in their paranoia. And Jim Jones was correct. There was a government conspiracy to get rid of People's Temple after a certain point. I mean, that's why the congressman was sent down to Guyana to conduct that investigation. And the post office was involved. The IRS was involved. None of them really wanted to be doing that, but, you know, this concerned citizens group in the Bay Area had gathered enough political support to make some things happen. And that is when he really began to see himself as a pariah and a victim. And he thought, well, if that's going to be the case, we might as well make this big historical punctuation mark on our group and say, look, fascist America, which is what he called it, drove us out for our beliefs, which isn't really true. They left because he was facing, you know, some sketchy legal situation in San Francisco. But, you know, he had everyone convinced that if they went back to the U.S., they would be put in jail, which – in prison, really, and that American prisons – he was saying this in the 70s, early 70s, that the American prison system was a system of concentration camps. And a lot of what he said about the police force, and it's all on tape, like I said, and a lot of what he said about the prison system has been echoed in a lot of the rhetoric and activism surrounding Black Lives Matter, surrounding Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. I mean, he was right about a lot of things, you know, wrong about some really – and made some terrible decisions, of course. But yes, they once they become too repulsive to the values of capitalist America, consumerism, the nuclear family, the 9-to-5, and so on, somebody, you know, gets it into their head that they've got to go, and will make that happen through, you know, political agitation. I'm not excusing anything that Jones did. He deserved to be investigated.
No, but it's clearly – the argument I think you're making is it's clearly more than just, you know, oh, well, a broken clock is right twice a day. It's like, well, no, it's more than that, because people
– It is.
– join these organizations because there is truth and meaning and persuasive ideas present.
Yeah.
It's just all the other stuff that comes with it that.
Yes. And that's right. And when you look at the roster of the folks who died in Jonestown, there were a lot of elderly black members of People's Temple who came up out of the South and went to the North as part of the Great Migration. These were the same people Father Divine scooped up into his movement. And the reason they could is because the Great Migration fractured a lot of families, and people were off of the kinship networks that they had in the South, and for 100 years, get to the North. Capitalism continues to fragment their families in these cities. The way of life is completely different, and people might move around a lot. And a lot of people were left without coherent social ties. The church becomes very important, but that wasn't enough for everyone. And these communes became really attractive to people who didn't have a formal kinship network outside of a church, like a nuclear family. And a lot of the folks who joined People's Temple and who died in Jonestown had that kind of background. And a lot of them came from the South. They were younger. They weren't part of the Great Migration, but they could not tolerate the racism of the South any longer and end up in California or join People's Temple when they swing through, because Jim Jones made all these mission trips to other cities to pick people up and bring them to California. And it worked. And these. By and large, when you talk to survivors of the movement, they were people who vocalized how alienated they felt from their community, from their society, from the American economy, how left for dead they already felt. And these groups said, "You have a place here." And so people sometimes ask me, "Well, do you think this is going to happen again?" And my answer to that is, it has happened again. The backdrop and the context is different. The Branch Davidians were nothing like People's Temple, very different religious orientation and political orientation. But the circumstances that gave rise to all of these groups are arising once more. We have deep social unrest, we have massive economic inequality, and we have a population that is still very entranced by metaphysical ideas. So the new manifestation would probably pick up where Jim Jones left off. He started really talking a lot less about Jesus, except when it was convenient, and incorporating a lot of Eastern ideas, a lot of things from Buddhism, and especially from Hinduism into his sermons, or whatever you want to call them, and as well as political ideology that was even more effective, the Leninist ideologies that he had. And I don't see why that couldn't happen again. Maybe it'll be someone who uses astrology or something else that's become much more relevant to younger people or to this generation, or self-help ideology. Or, as I point out in the book, there's this whole tech-oriented singularity movement that has like a digital futurist messianic timbre to it that is impossible to ignore.
And has a promise of immortality attached to it.
Correct.
I would say, yeah, in an uncertain, chaotic times, the appeal of conspiracy theories that offer us simple, organized, or even detailed explanations for complex, sometimes unanswerable questions. And I feel like that's always what's at the heart of it, whether it's QAnon or, take your pick, the Patriot movement. Once
Right.
people feel like they have a framework or astrology, and this isn't to take away anything from the possibilities that might exist in some metaphysical beliefs. I don't mean to do that. But anytime you have this lens through which you now view the world and world events, you feel that much more secure. Even if you're worried, even if you're like, okay, I know the apocalypse is next week, I better get ready for it. You still have this different sort of contentedness in your certainty that you understand the signs and meanings and the things around you. And not unlike partisan politics, where something happens in the world and immediately each of the two sides has their interpretation of it, and that becomes the hadith, the gospel of how we now view that particular topic. And yeah, it's all very fascinating. Last question for you is I want to ask about the cutting room floor of American messiahs. Surely there were other groups and individuals that you contemplated including, and the one that jumps to mind for me, based on everything else we've talked about and based on your personal history and where you're from, I'm surprised John Africa isn't in your book.
Well, yes. And I was actually thinking of, you're referring to MOVE, are
yes.
you not?
Yes. Formerly the Christian Movement for Life.
Right.
And I thought about primitivism, like so much stuff that you've touched
yes.
on.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I thought about bringing that up earlier in our conversation when I was talking about Philadelphia, because I also learned about MOVE during that summer and was totally horrified that this was not an extremely well-known event in American history. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were two big incidents with law enforcement, but I'm mainly referring to the bomb dropped on the house that killed practically everyone inside. And
yeah, we talk about the militarization of police now, and it's like we have like a Vietnam era style bombing in Philadelphia.
Domestic yeah. terrorism. And again, the allegation was really, oh, they're mistreating the children, and that mm-hmm. was based on nutrition. They were vegan, right? Mm-hmm. Or vegetarian mm-hmm. or something.
They were vegan, which is also now widely accepted.
Exactly. Yeah. A diet reform, by the way, is common to all these groups as well. Mm. Even Jim Jones passed through a vegetarian phase. The other thing that they were upset about was that these people were arming themselves. Well, as it turns out, that was pretty sensible.
right. same with the Branch Davidians. What were they afraid of? Well,
yeah, not to mention it's a second degree or Second Amendment right. Mm-hmm. Although, of course, the allegation is always they have more weapons than they have registered and so forth. But right. yeah, same with the Branch Davidians. And so I had to restrict myself in some way. And sure. I looked at the most successful of these groups that offered also a narrative device, which was they were paired historically into three pairs of two movements. There was Jemima Wilkinson and the Public Universal Friend, paired with Ann Lee, Thomas Lake Harris paired with Cyrus Teed, Jim Jones paired with Father Divine. Hmm. These movements were aware of each other. They were contemporary to each other. And I document a handover in each case of either an ideological movement that acted as a connector. Spiritualism connected the Quakers to Thomas Lake Harris, who first became a spiritualist medium before he developed his immortal breathing techniques. And Cyrus Teed was discovering the Black community and trying to do outreach there and incorporate, and he found his message very highly well received in Black churches after moving to Florida. He had to traverse some of the southern states, and he took the opportunity to preach in some of the Black churches. And some of his late writings, which he didn't publish but are in the archives in Florida, suggest that he began to understand the Black community as part of this bigger problem of capitalism. Or I should rephrase that and say he saw their oppression, their racial oppression, as necessary to the form of capitalism that he already hated. And he began to speak about that to his membership to acclimate them to the idea that they were going to integrate. And in his final novel, which he couldn't get published to save his life, although that was partly because it's not very good, is there's a future society imagined where a red race emerges on the island of Cuba. That's the amalgamation of all the other races. And this idea resurfaces later in the work of Jose Vasconcelos, a Mexican philosopher who talks about la raza cósmica, which is still – la raza is still a term used to refer to this kind of special mestizaje, amalgamation of races and so on. So he
– It's a great gangster rap song also.
Yeah, so he sees – Cyrus Teed in the late 19th century already sees the outlines of this, and Father Divine picks up from there. And I find circumstantial evidence that Father Divine's first guru, he read some of Cyrus Teed's works, which were widely distributed across certain parts, communities in Pennsylvania where he had followers. And this the terminology that they use, God in the fathership degree and the sonship degree, it's too odd to really be totally coincidental. And that is aside from the fact that the movements also adopted similar practices, as I say. So I didn't focus on MOVE because it had, just a different character in terms of its ideology, in terms of its location. Also, when it came down to it, and this is gets back to the cutting room floor, my editor and agent really wanted me to circumscribe historically and end things, with the exception of that epilogue, end things with People's Temple, because the other two groups I really wanted to talk about more were the Branch Davidians and then Yahweh Ben Yahweh's Nation of Yahweh.
Oh,
And that
yeah.
one is, and the reason I wanted to profile those, Ryan, is that the Jonestown changed a lot. It was kind of like a 9/11 incident in culturally, in that everybody who lived through it remembers it, and it had this downstream or echo effect that lasted for a decade. The whole anti-cult movement was something I wanted to include in the book. How it became a staple of daytime TV to have deprogrammers on who really rescued people from cults. That became a feature of my childhood, staying home from school watching Cutler
Same.
Donahue and
I mean,
whatnot. And
there was Donahue and all those shows with Satanic Panic coupled with, yeah,
exactly.
and the idea
Yeah.
of deprogramming and
And
how,
so,
wait, that's not a cult.
oh yes, and many critics of deprogrammers have said actually they employ the very methods they criticize. And anyway, I wanted to include those two movements to show how American messianic societies shifted from this open to all, countercultural, liberal version of Christianity towards a darker and more exclusive and secretive orientation. And the Nation of Yahweh, Black Hebrew nationalists, right? It was all black, and the Branch Davidians were not diverse either, and neither of them really were evangelical. They were much more strategic than that in terms of how they acquired members. And whereas you have Jim Jones literally crisscross and Father Divine crisscrossing the country on a bus, doing all kinds of media appearances, anything they could, these other groups tried to stay out of the spotlight. And you have a much more there's danger that adheres to these movements, and they know it because Bob Dole and the Senate had already been investigating ever since Jonestown the danger of cults hidden in Reagan's America. It was a cultural obsession, and you can really peg QAnon and this obsession with the occult. The most recent efflorescence of that kind of thinking was really that Satanic Panic of the 80s. And cult panic, and people just saw cults everywhere, and they were just on the brain because, your own kid could have gone to Jonestown and died, And
And that's
so
where
I
the
wanted.
fo that gets back to our folklore too, where, what town didn't have its folklore about, oh, that building there is a satanic temple where they do A, B, and C happens in there, and then suddenly believing that, this worldwide pedophile ring is being run out of a pizza place. How is that any different? It's the same type of,
And I wanted to show how there's continuity there too, that even though the communistic aspect of these 1990s and 80s and 90s groups was still there, they weren't left oriented in any other way, really. And they were very exclusive, as I say, and it's part of the way that they were responding to the culture, the fear of cults, but also to the way capitalism had changed in the meantime. And I wanted to draw a straight line from there to the singularity movement and how it's providing a sort of eschatology or, notion of immortality to people who don't have otherwise any religious beliefs or religious community. I attended the Singularity Summit. If you got to the end of the book, you'll see that I had to gate crash it because it's so expensive. And I got in, and I, As someone who was raised in a church that trended evangelical over the years that I was there, I was blown away by the similarities, not only between my own upbringing and the evangelical nature of the singularity movement, but the similarities between the singularity movement and all of these documents from the 19th century Second Great Awakening that I was looking at, and spiritualism. And, there's nothing new under the sun in America in some
Right.
ways.
It's funny you should mention that because I have, on a much more sort of micro level, I have some friends who run a business that is, well, they make t-shirts and merchandise that is all satanic imagery, but with the idea that it's anti-Christian. It's from that sort of Levian perspective, right? And they're atheists, and the Bible's a book of fairy tales, and why worship this God when there's thousands of gods, and very much in the Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, rest in peace, school. And yet, the reason why I mentioned them, and this isn't to disparage them at all, because they're my pals, but they are then the same folks who will post their new car on Instagram with a caption about how they manifested their success by, wishing into the universe. And it's like, okay, I understand why that you don't believe in a sky wizard who listens to your personal requests, and yet, you're telling your friends to read The Secret. That gets to your point of nothing new under the sun.
And this is a tangent that we don't have to go down since we've been talking for a while, but former member of the band Blondie and rock and roll fame inductee has written a book called Dark Star Rising. Well, I'm trying to recall his name. Gary. Shoot.
Where did I just see this? Did I see this on the back of your book?
Yes, that's his name.
Gary Lachman.
Gary Lachman has written a book called, I think it's called Dark Star Rising. It is
Magic
about,
and power in the age of Trump. Magic was
and he
the
talks
ooh
all
spell.
about not only Trump's history in Norman Vincent Peale's Church of Positive Thinking, but about the way that positive thinking manifested in the alt-right and how there was even somebody, and I want to say it was Spencer, who said that it was them manifesting, them being the alt-right, manifesting their will that got Trump elected. And he goes into also this concept of meme magic and how memes worked to conjure a very unreal outcome into reality. And it's fascinating, and there's tons of overlap between the occult and the right wing that actually is hopefully going to be my next project.
Oh, nice. Nice. You are speaking my language, pun intended, in all of these different
Yeah,
directions.
I'll coin it right here. I want to use the phrase occult right to designate that. I mean, this is
I have to
some.
back up from my microphone so I don't blow out your ears. That is
I mean, it goes
brilliant.
back to the 19th century, this alliance between the American vernacular occult and this sort of conspiratorial bent of mind that gets obsessed with Freemasons. That's also involved in Freemasonry, the anti-Masonic movement. That's, upstate New York is full of that kind of history. But then, the John Birch Society and the QAnon, all of it, all of this conspiratorial thinking that goes along with it just accommodates right-wing logic so effectively. And I want to look at that. I want to look at the history of that in the US, but really lean into the occult and occult movements that have actually flourished here. Most people aren't aware of the Silver Shirt movement, William Dudley Pelley, like an actual fascist movement that came out of the 1930s. And he was an occultist. That's how he got his start. And, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head how many followers there were, but, it was a real thing that happened here. And it came out of that whole California 1930s experimental period where a lot of people are dabbling in the occult.
I would think more recently, Boyd Rice and the Process Church and some of those that are, I wouldn't describe them as fascist or white supremacists, but they certainly flirt with the imagery and pieces of the ideology. And I feel like those types of characters act as gateway drugs into some of the deeper, more sinister
They do.
stuff
There's
you can get
certainly a
into.
gateway drug to that Norse mythology that you were talking about earlier, and sort of Thule and the Germanic kind of obsession with old European occultism. Yeah, it's all there, and I'm just trying to clear some runway to get into that.
Oh, I love it. Well, I'd be happy to feed you any potential interview subjects and so on for that.
Oh, terrific.
Previously on the podcast already, I've had a couple of architects of the Norwegian black metal movement, including one who was, arrested for church burning, on the podcast. And I think there's a some people grit their teeth and reject this premise, but I would say a great larger number certainly connects a lot of the black metal thing to that neo-paganism, old European tradition stuff that you just referenced also. So yeah, man, a cult, right? There it
Yeah,
is.
there it is. Stay tuned.
Oh, fantastic. Well, Adam, thank you so much for coming on and reaching back out to me and connecting. This has been one of my favorite conversations I've had for this thing. And the whole idea of the podcast is to bring aboard creative people who have something unique to say about belief or unbelief and everything between. And you fit that bill in a spectacular fashion. So look forward
Glad to hear
to
it.
inviting you back sometime.
Well, thank you, Ryan, for having me.
Yeah, thanks. I will let you know when this goes up and get it all over to you.
Great.
All right, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye
Take
bye.
care.